Good morning, everyone. We are opening the Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue. Happy New Year. We are going to go through our agenda in order and go through and look at primarily how the Federal Tax Act will interface with Oregon. Before we do that, let me move into a work session for purposes of introducing some bills. We have three committee bills. I'll ask Chris to give a very brief summary of each one, but I should also point out that when these were introduced in November, the world has changed, and almost all of the language in these three bills will be replaced. But Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The first bill is relating to business taxation, and the language in there contains provisions pertaining to broadcaster apportionment, pass-through entities, and throwback sales, so it's a business perspective. The second one is related to taxation. It has a couple of credits and a property tax issue in there. And then the third one is our standard reconnect bill, and right now the way it's drafted, it just updates the date. It has no other changes in it.
Very Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 194 dated 1-8-18, LC 195 dated 1-2-18, and LC 197 dated 1-8-18 be introduced as committee bills, and then I will speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves the committee approve the introduction of bills LC 194, LC 195, and LC 197. Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind members of the committee and the public at large that the introduction of legislative concepts neither indicates the support or opposition to the concept itself. These concepts, of course, are placeholders for the results of future discussions and debates that we have amongst ourselves and with the public. As usual, we look forward to working together regarding these concepts in the future, and I would just add to the caveat to dispel the myths that float around this building that, you know, the minority party, and I think I even speak for the majority members of here who aren't in leadership in this committee, this committee has had a tradition of working together based on the leadership of the chair, and we look forward to continuing to working together regardless of affiliation as we go forward.
Thank you. Further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. So let's move to taking a look at the federal tax changes and much anticipated presentation from Chris Allenack. And we'll let you start, Chris, and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So this presentation is the same one that was presented on Wednesday in front of House Revenue, and I go through where we are when understanding the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. As indicated on the slide there, I would characterize this as an update as research and discussions and review of the legislation is still ongoing, and every day we're still learning more about the details of the act. So just to set up the discussion this morning, I'm briefly going to outline this, the summary of the provisions, provide some large context on the number of provisions in the bill, and then I'm going to talk about individual provisions. These are mostly household or personal income tax type of provisions. Talk about changes to tax rates, deductions, and mention some other changes, and then get into some preliminary revenue impacts, and then move on to the business provisions, again, touching on reductions, increases, or offsets, and preliminary impacts. And then I have a slide on the international provisions in the bill. This is probably the area where we still have the greatest amount of understanding to gain. And then wrap up with some specific Oregon impact details around specific provisions, and then provide a couple of examples to give a flavor of the puts and takes. And then there's some potential responses at the end by both stakeholders, the private sector and the public sector. So to outline the bill, there were about 115 provisions in the bill. And the way I've set up this discussion here is in three categories, talking about individuals, talking about businesses, and then international, because that's a special case. Keeping in mind that the individuals, for the most part, as I said, this is the personal income tax and how households are affected, but it does include the pass-through deduction. So that's kind of the one exception to that. The business provisions will ultimately affect both the corporate income tax and the personal income tax. But the policy approaches and a lot of the discussion in the media has been along these lines, so I'm just continuing that. And then the international provisions. So there are 30 individual provisions that are temporary. They're in effect for 8 years, 2018 through 2025. And then most of the other provisions are permanent beginning in 2018. There are about 65 business provisions and then 20 international. And despite that, most of the revenue impact is driven by a handful of provisions, and those are the ones listed in the table here. And by the impact here, I'm talking both at the federal level and Oregon. And I'm going to try and be as clear as I can when I'm talking about federal impacts versus Oregon impacts, because as everybody's aware, it's a significant tax change for individuals and the federal taxes they'll pay, and then how that affects the Oregon taxes and then the Oregon General Fund. The table here, to draw back on information I presented back in November, we have direct effects and indirect effects. Now, the table here, the pluses and minuses indicate the change in either Oregon tax or federal tax, the direction of the change given the change in the policy. So, for example, the first item there, tax rates, the federal tax rates were cut. So that is a negative for federal tax. It's a reduction in federal taxes. And because Oregon has, on the personal income tax side, we have our federal tax subtraction. Basically, Oregonians are allowed to subtract or deduct off their Oregon taxes the amount of federal tax they pay. So with a reduction in federal tax, Oregonians will have a smaller federal tax subtraction, and from that policy, they might pay a little more in Oregon tax. Basically, a smaller deduction on the Oregon return results in greater Oregon tax. So the pluses, if the signs are opposite, those are what we refer to as the indirect effects, and it's driven through that change in the federal tax subtraction. If the signs are moving in the same direction, those are the direct effects. And here we have itemized deductions and the pass-through entity deduction. Those have the largest impact on Oregon. So to kind of bottom line the impact of the pieces that we understand now, this chart contains the individual provisions and the business provisions. It does not include the potential impact of the international, and I'll get to more of that later. But right now we have the blue bars are the impact to individuals. And so in 2018, we're looking at about a $50 million tax reduction in 2018. And then throughout the remainder of the time period, it's a tax reduction that first falls to about 25 or 30 million and then gradually increases. And then because these provisions are temporary, once we get to 2026, there's actual a tax increase compared to current law. Now the orange are brown are the business provisions. And here we have in 2018 about a $50 million revenue loss, and that by 2020 turns into a revenue gain. Now, for all of the policies that are thrown in here, there are a couple of key drivers. On the individual side, the revenue loss here, or the tax reduction, is driven by the new pass-through entity deduction. And I'll provide some specific numbers later on. But if not for that provision, then this would be a revenue gain for Oregon. But that one flips the sign and turns it into a revenue loss for the general fund. On the brown here, the reason for this trend is really driven by bonus depreciation is the biggest piece. As I think all committee members are aware, bonus depreciation just front loads the deductions for businesses on the machinery and equipment that they invest. And so that front loads the deduction, so that moves deductions forward in time. So there is a tax reduction in the first couple of years, but then it actually leads to a tax increase in later years. Because for a given business, what they were going to deduct in, say, 2021, they may now get to deduct in 2018. So there's a minus in the early years and a plus in the later years. Another provision that drives the increase is a reduction in net interest, a limit on the net interest deduction businesses can claim on their returns. And then another one is a limitation on research and development expenses. That provision doesn't even take effect until 2023, and it's another limitation on business deductions. The theme for businesses here at the federal level, the large driver of the revenue reduction at the federal level is the lowering of the corporate tax rate, going from 35 to 21%. So that's the big reduction. And then many of the other provisions actually add revenue. They're offsets to that reduction. And we're not tied to the impact of the corporate tax rates, but we are generally tied to those pieces that increase the tax base, reduce the deductions. So jumping into the individual provisions, and these are the pieces that affect only the personal income tax. So in simplest terms, despite, I don't want to oversimplify it, or well, maybe that's valuable. In simplest terms, income tax is calculated where you have gross income minus deductions equals taxable income. Gross income is wages, capital gains, business income, all that goes into a pot. And then you take certain deductions, the standard and itemized deductions are the biggest ones that people are familiar with, and that results in taxable income. Taxable income times the tax rates is the gross tax, and then gross tax minus tax credits is the net tax liability or the tax that people pay. So Congress changed just about everything, and there are a lot of puts and takes there that make it a little bit tricky to describe the impact because it does vary across taxpayers and the specifics of any individual taxpayer. The changes that have the biggest impact on Oregon taxes are the deductions. That's really a tax base issue. When that, we are tied to the federal tax base, so when that increases or decreases, that has the biggest impact on Oregon. So the federal tax rates for single and joint filers are right here, and the prior law is the blue line, and then the brown line or the orange line is the new law. And so this is a graphical representation of the tax rates. So on the bottom line here is taxable income as it increases, and this is the tax rate. So for the first chunk of income for single filers, it's about $9,000. That income is taxed at 10% under prior law and the new law. The next chunk of income from about $10,000 to $30,000 or $40,000 had been taxed at 15% right here and is now taxed at 12%. And so on and so forth. So the next chunk of income, the rate fell from 25% down to 20%. Part of the reason for showing this is that we do have a stretch of income here where the tax rate actually went up. So for this piece of income, if you're talking in $180,000, $190,000 for a single filer under prior law, they were paying a 28% tax rate. And so that actually went up to 32 or 33%. And then by the time we get to the top end of the income, the rate was reduced from 39.6% down to 37%. The joint filers, the income brackets are doubled, and the view of the income tax bracket is basically any length of a flat bar part of the chart here. The joint probably fits intuition a little bit better in that it's almost universally shifted down, except for one small chunk of income here around $425,000. So for this is the start of the driver for reducing taxes at the federal level. It's important to keep in mind, though, that anybody who is, say, right in here, the $180,000, $190,000, for those marginal dollars being taxed at a higher rate, they still benefited from the lower rates and all of that income below that. So they don't jump in here and the rate causes a tax increase. They've benefited from all of the income below that at a lower rate. So moving on to deductions, under prior law, from one perspective, there were two deductions at the federal level, the personal exemption deduction and the larger of either the standard or itemized deductions. The personal exemption deduction was $4,150 per person. So a family of four would get about a little more than $16,000 in personal exemption deductions. And then they would tack on either their standard or itemized deduction. And the standard was $650 for single, $13,000 for joint. And the itemized deductions, I think most people are familiar with these. We have the state and local taxes, the home mortgage interest, and charitable contributions are kind of the big three. And then there was what was known as the PEAS limitation. Basically, for higher income folks, once a taxpayer's income got to a certain level, the amount of itemized deductions they could take would be phased down. So as income increased in a certain range, the amount of itemized deductions was actually limited. And it would be, it wasn't phased out, but it was reduced. So the changes in the new law, we still effectively have two deductions at the federal level, but they're of a very different nature. First of all, the personal exemption was eliminated. So that family of four that was getting a $16,000 deduction for personal exemptions, that $16,000 went away. The new deduction is the pass-through entity income deduction, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in another slide. And then the larger of the standard or itemized deductions. And this is where the standard deduction was roughly doubled to 12,000 single, 24,000 joint, and I think it was 18,000 for head of household. And the itemized deductions were also changed. This got a lot of attention. There is now a $10,000 cap for the combination of income and property taxes. And there's a repeal of the PEAS limitation. So that's another change. And then other itemized deductions were limited. So that's a high-level view of the change in deductions. Those that were reduced, and then my next slide is a brief discussion of those that were increased, is the personal exemption. Under current law, the blue line is what the projections were for the personal exemption over time. Right now it was around the $4,000. It is indexed to inflation. That's another key piece that was changed, and I'll touch on that. The nature of inflation adjustments have changed, but under prior law, that personal exemption deduction was projected to reach just over $5,000 by 2027. With the new act, it was reduced to zero for 8 years, and then because the law sunsets, we go back to the prior personal exemption, but we use this new way of calculating inflation. So in 2026 and 2027, under prior law, that had projected to be, say, about $5,300. But under the new law, when we bounce back to a personal exemption, instead of it being $5,300, it'll just be $5,000. So that's a piece of where there's a tax increase for individuals and households after it sunsets. The itemized deductions that were reduced, we have the property tax and income tax limit of $10,000. Home equity debt is no longer allowed, and there is a limit on some mortgage debt for loans over $750,000. And disallowed itemized deductions are some casualty losses. Those are only allowed under certain circumstances now. And then what are actually called miscellaneous deductions on the Schedule A? And for the most part, there are a couple examples there, but the concept is amounts paid to produce or collect taxable income. And to the extent that these expenses exceed 2% of AGI, taxpayers were allowed to deduct that amount. That has gone away. One of the classic examples here might be for my employment, if I'm required to have a uniform and I have to pay for it and it's not reimbursed by my employer, I can deduct it as long as the sum total of those expenses exceed 2% of AGI. Deductions that were increased, we have the standard deduction, which doubled. This is for joint filers where we bounced up to about 24,000. It is indexed to inflation. But again, when the provision sunset and we go back, we revert to the prior law, because of the different way of calculating inflation, the projected standard deduction in 2027 is actually lower than it had been under prior law. So prior law would have put that at, say, 15,500, and then it gets reduced to 15,200. That's another source of some of the tax increases in 26 and 27. I mentioned the PEAS limitation repeal. With the repeal of that, and this is kind of a little backwards thinking about it, but it's a repeal of the limitation, so some deductions like mortgage interest and charitable contributions could actually increase for taxpayers. If they had been affected by the PEAS limitation under prior law, where their itemized deductions had been reduced, with the elimination of that limit, some of these deductions can actually increase for some taxpayers. It all depends on the mix of the provisions. And lastly here, we have the pass-through deduction. And this is perhaps one of the bigger policy pieces in here. It applies to pass-through entities, S-corps, partnerships, LLCs, and it also applies to sole proprietors. One thing we're looking at here is how this interacts or affects or doesn't interact with the Oregon. Now, the Oregon pass-through, and you're going to hear a presentation from Kyle next on that, that's the Oregon policy that's been in effect since 2015. That applies to partnerships and S-corps and only to the non-passive or the active income of those businesses. The big difference here is that instead of at the federal level, there's a deduction instead of a preferential rate, and the policy includes sole proprietors and applies to all income, both non-passive and passive. And for taxpayers with less than 315,000 joint or 157,000 single, the 20% deduction is unlimited. And it's a 20% deduction of what is termed qualified business income. And I think all stakeholders are still looking at exactly what that means, but effectively it's all of the income and deductions that go into calculating taxable income. And then if income is above those limits, it is phased out for certain types of businesses, what the bill refers to as specified service businesses. So we're talking about health, law, consulting, CPA, actuarial, performing arts. If you're in one of those sectors and your income is above these limits, it is phased out. Examples of businesses that aren't phased out, I think it exempted engineering and architectural. So some, depending on the nature of the firm, the deduction may or may not be limited. And there is also limitations, some formulas about tying the deduction or having it limited by wages paid by the firm. The idea here is that if I'm an employee for a company and, say I'm a consultant and I'm an employee, so I'm getting paid wages and my income is $300,000 or $400,000, I don't benefit from this deduction. But if I end my employee relationship, start my own LLC, and continue doing the same work, but as an independent contractor, I can now get the deduction. And so one of the ways of limiting that is if I do that, I still have to call some of my income wages. So there is the Congress was aware of some potential behavioral responses, so they took steps to mitigate that to some extent. Only time will tell how that really plays out. And then for Oregon, one of the things we're looking at is how it steps on or interacts with the Oregon policy, because It could be that the way the language spells out is that there's a double deduction for some folks. I mean, they may get a deduction of this income and they get the preferential rate to all of the income, even the income that effectively wasn't taxed between the deduction. If the laws are interpreted a different way, the revenue impacts may be one or the other. But those are the this is an area where we still have questions. The Department of Revenue is still looking at it. All stakeholders are still looking at it to see how exactly it plays out.
Could you scroll up? I mean, slightly different than our previous discussion. So I have a question on line 3 from the bottom right-hand side. That's unlimited if income is below, and we'll skip the second one, but unlimited below is 315,000 joint, I'm assuming, right? And phased out over 100,000. So am I correct in saying that it's zero over 315,000, and then at the 100,000 mark, it starts tearing down from the 20%. Is that what you're saying?
It's unlimited up to 315,000,
right,
and then it phases down as income goes from 315 to 415,
right,
and then at 415, it's zero.
So the phase out over, it says 100,000 and 50,000. What does that mean again?
Single.
Yeah, the 100,000 is for joint. So a joint filer, they get, if I qualify for this, I get an unlimited deduction as long as my income is under $315,000.
Right.
But as my income increases from $315,000 to $415,000, the amount of deduction I get reduces to zero.
So the 100,000 is added to the 315, which gets you, because you're using this 4 number, and I'm looking at a 1 trying to figure out what you're talking about.
It's added up. I'm sorry. Okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So other changes include, under prior law, there was a $1,000 tax credit for qualifying children, and a qualifying child was somebody basically under the age of 17. So the parents would get that $1,000 tax credit. Under the new law, that $1,000 was increased to $2,000, and there was a phase-out range, too, that was also change. So this credit is much more broadly available to taxpayers. And then a new piece of it is for other dependents that aren't qualifying children, there's a new tax credit of $500.
Senator Butcher.
Tax credits, though, they don't affect, that wouldn't affect Oregon income tax because that's just a tax credit. It doesn't lower the income or anything.
It does not have a direct effect. It does have an indirect effect. So if, just to simplify everything, if the only change in my federal tax situation was a $1,000 federal tax decrease because I have one child and my credit went from $1,000 to $2,000. So the bottom line, my federal taxes go down by $1,000. My federal tax subtraction on the Oregon return could fall by $1,000. And so then my Oregon taxes would increase by 9% of the $1,000. So there's the possible indirect effect.
That's a positive for Oregon.
Right. At the federal level, there is the AMT, the alternative minimum tax. At one point, it was repealed, but it's still in the law. It's just modified so that fewer taxpayers are affected by it. That's the exemption increase and the phase-out threshold. Basically, only the higher of the fewer higher, only the highest income folks can be affected by it now. Fewer taxpayers are going to be affected by that at the federal level. One other change that has, I don't have it in the slide here, but has popped up in recent days is a change to the 529 plans and how that money can be used. So the feds, prior law limited the use of those 529 funds to higher education. Within this act, they now allow those funds to be used for primary and secondary education, basically K through 12. So that's an example of, we're not thinking that it has a big revenue impact, but it does have some policy implications for the state on whether or not the legislature wants to tie to that provision or not. So that's on our list. There's not a lot of detail here, but that's something we'll be getting into more information as we move into February. And the last piece, this inflation factor, it's something that's been, this is where we're moving from the CPI to the change CPI. And it's been talked about a lot. Usually only economists get excited about this kind of thing, but it has made its way into law now. And the takeaway from that is by using the chain CPI, price increases over time are less. So all of the changes to parameters in the tax law, the standard deduction, the personal exemption, they are adjusted to inflation. Even the tax brackets, they're adjusted to inflation for how the cost of living changes over time. And by using a chain CPI instead of the CPI, if you will, those price changes are less because it basically accounts for consumer preferences. If I'm consuming product A and the price increases, I might switch to product B, which is a close substitute. And so my actual experience in the cost of living isn't quite as high. But that's the takeaway. And that's where those prior lines on the standard exemption and the personal standard deduction and personal exemption were lower when we bounce back. So the brackets won't increase as fast as they would have under prior law.
Question. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. CPI still doesn't include food or energy?
The main one is this U.S. city average, so it's a lot of things that are boiled down. And there are actually many different kinds of CPI, but the one that gets used is this U.S. city average, and it's just a chain version of that to what I understand now. Again, we're still going through this, and every day we are learning new things. But yeah, it's just not the watered down, like an aggregate version. I shouldn't say watered down, but it's an aggregate piece.
It'd be interesting to get the real definition of the new CPI.
We can get that for you.
That one corrupt is the last one.
Okay, so to wrap up the individual piece, this chart has caused some confusion, but I've tried to focus on the three pieces. We have a change in federal taxes, which can affect the federal tax subtraction in Oregon, and then the impact on Oregon taxes. And so we have a 10-year period here, 2018 through 2027. And starting with the blue line, we have the change in federal taxes, and it's about $1.5 billion federal tax reduction for Oregonians for the first 8 years. And then once those provisions sunset in 2026 and 2027, It's actually a federal tax increase, and this is driven by the different CPI. And that, so speaking for the 8 years, the $1.5 billion federal tax reduction translates into about a $500 million reduction in the federal tax subtraction. And usually we don't focus on this a lot because the federal tax changes aren't that significant. But at a reduction in the federal tax subtraction of about $500 million a year, $500 million times the 9%, we're talking about $40 to $50 million reduction or addition to Oregon taxes. And then the bottom line for Oregon is a slight, in aggregate, a $29 million reduction or so for those 8 years, and then a slight increase. And this table over here boils this chart down to a few numbers, and these are the average annual changes. So for tax years 28 to 2025, federal taxes fall by just under $1.5 billion. The federal tax subtraction falls by $500 million, and Oregon taxes fall by $29 million. That's with everything thrown in together. And then when we get to the last 2 years, again, driven by the change in CPI, federal taxes increase at $375 million. The federal tax subtraction increases $94 million. And then Oregon taxes increase $18
million. One question.
Senator Bershinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go too far, can you go back to slide 7, Chris? So you said something in there that kind of I had to run through my brain a little bit. On the single, as it steps up to the different tax rates, is that a step up? In other words, say the first $50,000 I get taxed at this rate, the next $50,000 I get taxed at this rate, the next $50,000 I get taxed at this rate, or do I get the $150,000 I just get taxed at the highest rate? Is that
the former? The former. And that's when we use the language marginal rates, that's what that means.
Right.
But it's a common confusion. I've often gotten that question that if a person takes a pay raise and they get moved into a higher tax bracket, does all of their income get taxed at that higher rate? And it does not.
Right.
Okay. It's just that marginal piece. So the way you first described it, the first $50,000, then the next $50,000,
right,
and so forth.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was clear on
mm-hmm.
that.
So the business tax reductions, the largest by far value is the 21% C corporation tax rate. It was reduced from a high of 35% down to 21%, and that's the largest tax reduction for corporations and businesses. And then, as I mentioned before, a lot of the pieces then actually add back or offset that cost a little bit is the approach that Congress took. I just mentioned a few here that drive some of the revenue impact. The bonus depreciation is something that has been described as a temporary policy, but we've been talking about it, and it's been renewed for 15 to 20 years now. And under current law, it was a 50% bonus depreciation. So basically, if I'm a business and I buy some equipment, the core concept is that machine is going to last, say, 5 years, and under a baseline or normal, if those are the right terms, I would deduct that expense over 5 years, maybe 20% every year. But with bonus depreciation, I get to deduct more of that in the first year. So under 50% bonus depreciation, I would get to deduct deduct half that cost in the first year, and the rest would be deducted over time. And so the bill moves us from 50% bonus depreciation to 100% bonus depreciation through tax year 2022. And that's basically expensing. If you can write off the full cost of that kind of investment in 1 year, it's called expensing. Then this 100% bonus depreciation phases down through 2026 until it's only 20% in 2026, and then it sunsets in 27. So the corporation tax rate is an across-the-board tax reduction every year. The bonus depreciation is a tax reduction in the first few years and the tax increase in later years. The corporation AMT was repealed. There is kind of a new piece related to the international, and I'll get to that in a little bit. Small business cash accounting, basically the availability of cash accounting has been expanded, so that's a tax reduction. And then Section 179 expensing. This is an amount of business expense that doesn't have to be depreciated. You just get to claim it in 1 year. And the maximum amount was increased from 500,000 to a million. So as long as the total of my equipment that I purchased in the year is under $1 million, I can expense it all. I don't have to depreciate it. And there is a phase out threshold, and that's been increased from 2 million to 2.5 million. And if the total amount of my equipment that I invested exceeds 2.5 million, then the amount I get to expense is phased out. It's reduced as my total cost exceeds. So if I spent $10 million on business equipment, this doesn't have any value to me. So it's another kind of phase out. The bonus depreciation would, and they definitely interact with each other.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Maybe I missed something. What was, do you have any sense of why the repeal of the AMT? It seems inconsistent with the mission of the whole.
It can be described as a technical change in the sense that at the federal level, there is a significant change in how corporations are taxed.
Yeah.
We're going from a worldwide system to a territorial system. And this is something that has been talked about for a while. And many of the OECD countries, they have some version of a territorial system. Mm-hmm. The key feature or the starting point is under a worldwide system, the key factor or the starting factor is the residency of the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So under our prior system, the worldwide system, if you're a U.S. corporation, we're going to tax all of your income wherever you earn it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it gets a lot more complicated, and there are a lot of deductions with foreign income and so forth. But the key starting point is residency. You're a U.S. corporation. We get to tax your income throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets complicated. Under a territorial system, we don't care where your residency is. We're only going to tax the income that you earn in the U.S. And then it gets complicated. But that's a key perspective change. And within the new system here, and I do have one slide to just touch on these points, there is something that is being referred to as BEAT, base erosion and BEAT, base erosion anti or abuse tax. And that can be viewed as a new kind of minimum tax. So the repeal of the prior AMT basically needed to be changed. So that one didn't work. The old AMT didn't work under a territorial system, so it was eliminated. And we have now what is called a BEAT, or that's the...
It's replaced,
yeah.
Okay.
It's replaced.
Because it does not seem concurrent with... Okay, got it. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Question.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last line, Chris, run that by me again here. So maximum 179 went to a million. So I go buy $1 million piece of equipment this year. Okay. We're in the new tax year. So I'm assuming it's in. So I can expense that whole $1 million. Now, the threshold is, explain the threshold again. And are either of these sunsetted in 2017?
I'm on the sunset piece. I think it is. I'll have to double check. There are a lot of different time periods. The bonus depreciation is, and usually those go hand in hand. So I think the Section 179 is, but I'll double check on that. And the threshold here, the phase out is as long as my total equipment is less than, so I bought $2.5 million of equipment.
Right.
I can expense $1 million of that.
Right.
And this is setting aside the bonus depreciation because they do interact. But then as let's say my total equipment expense is $3 million, mm-hmm. I can only expense $500,000 because as my purchases exceed $2.5 million, for every dollar above the $2.5 million, the amount that I can expense is reduced by a dollar. So that by the time I get to $3.5 million, I can't use the Section 179 expensing.
Senator Booker.
Okay, so it's sort of a reverse, but it's basically, in economic terms, what it's trying to do is say, is if you only have $1.5 million in cash and you're going to go buy $1 million worth of piece of equipment, you get this. But if you had so much cash that you could have gone paid for this anyway, you don't get it when it gets above $2.5 million.
Right. It's also...
So it's targeting small business below $2.5 million in purchasing power and treats them as, gives them advantage, but if you're a pass-through Warren Buffett, and I'm not taking a negative at him. You're saying huge entity that's a private and you have a pass-through. Because you have so much cash and you can go buy equipment, you don't get it because you have so much on hand.
Correct.
Okay.
It's focused on small businesses. So some of the increases, for the increases or the offsets, and by offset, I mean offset to the tax loss from the reduction in corporate rate. These are a handful of the increases that we are tied to, which drive the preliminary gain to Oregon tax revenue from businesses. There's a limit to the net interest deduction. Businesses can't deduct, or it's the amount of interest that they can deduct is limited to 30% of their income. There's also a limitation to net operating losses. Now, for this provision, it only applies to the pass-through entities. For Oregon law, we have our own NOL law. So the change of the federal law doesn't affect Oregon because we have our own. We're disconnected from the federal law, but it does affect pass-throughs. The R&D, the research and development, or research and experimentation amortization is changed from largely one where it was an expense-driven. You could like expense everything in 1 year, but now you have to deduct it over many years, so that raises revenue. Again, it doesn't start till 2023, so there's no effect here, but one of the drivers when this starts to bump up is this provision taking effect. The domestic production activities deduction was eliminated at the federal level. This doesn't affect Oregon because when the feds introduced this back in 2005, I think, we immediately disconnected from it. And then there are other deduction limitations at the federal level, like entertainment, meals, and expenses. Some of those have been either curtailed or eliminated, and we're tied to that tax base. All of those, the reduction in deductions expands the tax base, increases taxable income, and then we see more revenue from that. So this is the one slide I have on the international taxation. And we are still trying to figure out exactly what the impact on Oregon revenue is. Just to reference that first slide I included on the individuals and businesses, the impact of this we're still working on. For a while, we were thinking it would be a revenue gain because it's bringing all this money into the federal, and that we would benefit from that. But to take a step back, we're moving from the worldwide system to the territorial system, which I described a minute ago. And one of the concerns here is how that might interact with the tax haven law. But one of some of the key provisions around this new system, as we change from focusing on business residency to the location of the production where things are produced, where the income is earned, if you will, three of the key features here are a deduction for dividends received by U.S. corporations from foreign corporations. And the idea here is that we're starting with all the income and we're deducting income that you earned overseas. So maybe an easy way to think about it is under the prior law, a U.S. corporation, we're going to tax everything in the world, but if you earned it overseas, we're not going to tax it until you bring it back to the U.S. It's a deferral system, basically saying, okay, you earn that income in Africa or Europe or wherever, and we're not going to tax yet, even though it's kind of on the books because we're tracking it. Once you bring that money back into the U.S., we're going to tax it. Under the territorial system, we're still starting with an overall total of income, but if you earn that income in France, then you're going to get a deduction because we're not going to tax it, period. And so we have
questions left.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I didn't interrupt you again. I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but then won't that cause those countries then to start taxing them in their countries?
Yeah. Well, many of these countries have a territorial system. I'm sorry?
They already do tax them in some way,
right?
Obviously.
So the situation at the international level isn't that different from within the U.S. and the sales factor on how the different states tax, where it can land either direction, where you can get nowhere income not taxed or double taxed, depending on how the systems interact. So you're exactly right that just moving to a territorial system doesn't make everything simple and clean and we're good to go. It's still very complicated. And it still presents a chance for corporations to manipulate where their profits are earned or labeled or attributed. And so that's one. The next bullet item here, the tax on global intangible low-taxed income, the acronym that people are using is GILTI, is a way to stop that.
You got to have a little humor here.
We all laughed when we heard it, too, in the first go-round. Let's point that out to you. So.
Excuse me.
And so that's an attempt to Congress recognized, okay, the proponents of this say a territorial system is going to be better for competitive nature of U.S. corporations. We're going to benefit, and we're going to see growth in the economy and so forth. But they also recognize that there's still games that can be played, if you will. So this is one of the steps to mitigate that, along with the base erosion and anti-abuse tax. This is the BEAT, which is what I discussed before. It's kind of a minimum tax. So these are new provisions. So we're going under a new system.
You can be BEAT if you're guilty.
And so that's what we're trying to understand all this. Now, one of the key pieces in this switching from a worldwide to a territorial system is this notion of repatriation. Because under the worldwide system, most of the international corporations have income that they've earned overseas, and they've parked that cash overseas because they didn't want to pay tax. In the U.S., they didn't repatriate it. And in 2004 and 2005, the feds, under the Bush administration, Congress passed a temporary incentive for corporations to bring that money back to the U.S. If they voluntarily brought it back to the U.S., it would be taxed at a lower rate. What the big difference now is that this repatriation is not a choice. All of this money will be taxed. It's deemed repatriated. It doesn't matter if you bring it back to the U.S. or not. It's going to be deemed repatriated, and we're going to tax it. And it's going to be taxed at either 15.5% or 8%, depending on cash. And what we're talking about are all undistributed and non-taxed foreign earnings since 1986. So we're basically going back to the last major tax change in the U.S. and saying any of this money that's parked overseas is going to be deemed repatriated, and we're going to tax it at either 8% or 15.5%, depending on the nature of the money, of the asset. And some estimates put that the amount of cash overseas at $2.5 to $3 trillion, somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion of cash. And so that's going to create that's a huge offset in the federal legislation. And so all of this applies to tax year 2017. So corporations are already, once we hit it in a couple of months, corporations are going to be filing their 2017 returns throughout the year. And so this money will be coming in to the U.S. The tax liability will kind of show up on the 2017 returns. They'll have 8 years to pay it at the federal level. And the question for Oregon is, are we or are we not tied to that? Because at first thought, we were thinking, well, it's an increase in federal taxable income. We're tied to that, and there'll be a revenue gain in the first year for Oregon that would offset the losses that we're projecting for 2018. But we actually might need legislation in the Reconnect bill to ensure that. Because of the technical way that the statute is written, it looks like we may not be tied to the way that the feds did this. So the income will be coming in. But it could actually be a revenue loss for the state. And this is something that's just come up within the past week, and I'm still, playing connect the statutes to figure it out, and I'm talking to various stakeholders. And at this point, I wouldn't characterize the situation as universal agreement. Different folks that I've talked to or I'm in the middle of having conversations with are viewing this differently. And so right now, we don't know if it's a revenue gain or revenue loss for 2018, which is why it wasn't included on that first slide, because if there's not agreement on what the statute says, it presents certain challenges to estimating the impact of that.
Chris, I'm wondering if you could give us a hypothetical on this, because it seems so counterintuitive to everyone that if we're going to repatriate $2 to $3 trillion and now begin taxing it, that somehow Oregon loses money in that. Could you walk us through why that may be the case?
I can try to walk you through my current understanding, and we'll see how this goes. Okay, so you have a company
super crazy
that has $1 million of deemed and I was just talking to some folks yesterday about this. They have $1 million of deemed repatriations. So they have $1 million overseas, and we're talking about an Oregon company. And they have $1 million of these deemed repatriations. So that gets added to their tax return. That income gets added. They're going to be taxed at the $1 million. But that $1 million is going to be taxed at either some combination of 15.5% and 8%. And the way the feds get to that is saying, okay, we're not going to tax the $1 million. You're going to get a deduction such that the income that we do tax results in, say, an 8% tax on the $1 million. So if we get a little bit loose with the math, this company has $1 million in deemed repatriations. They get a $700,000 dividend reduction, and the U.S. will tax just $300,000. Okay, I'm not really working on the arithmetic, but so there's an increase in federal taxable income of $300,000. And that's where we think, well, we're tied to federal taxable income, so we get to tax that $300,000. So that said, okay, so we have that. And if we said this is, now we get into the way the state handles dividend received deductions, the DRDs. And these are situations where corporations, as I think everybody's aware, corporations will own entirely or certain shares of other corporations. So if Corporation A fully owns Corporation B, and Corporation B pays a dividend to Corporation A, that dividend paid to Corporation A, they get to deduct that amount because that income was already taxed when Corporation B filed their tax return. So the takeaway here is that there are these things called DRDs, and the feds have their law about it. And Oregon basically said, we're going to disconnect from that, and we're going to have our own DRDs. So when the corporation calculates their tax returns under prior law, we'd start with federal taxable income. They add back all of their federal DRDs, and then we allow the Oregon DRDs. Okay. So now, with that in mind, because of that, those statutes, when we add back the federal DRDs, we point to specific points in the Internal Revenue Code. We say you go to point X and you add back those DRDs, you go to point Y and add back those DRDs. So what the feds just did was they created a new DRD. And so while their federal taxable income went up by $300,000, Oregon law does not add back any of the federal DRDs. So we're missing that add back piece, but then we require, I don't know why they wouldn't claim it, an Oregon DRD of the $1 million. So federal taxable income went up by $300,000. We don't add back the DRD because we're missing that provision, because it's a new DRD. We didn't know about it. We couldn't point to it in law. So federal taxable income goes up by $300,000. We allow, it's an 80% reduction, or dividend deduction. So instead of the $1 million, it's actually $800,000 is our dividend reduction. So $300,000 increase in federal taxable income, an $800,000 decrease in taxable income. The net is an actually $500,000 decrease in taxable income. And I will be shocked if that's clear.
I think that's a good effort. Are you saying that with a piece of legislation we could fix that, or it's separate from the Reconnect legislation? We just need to pass a law
to connect
that,
or do we disconnect, or what is the remedy there?
The policy options are basically saying, what we're missing in our current law is to add back the new federal DRD.
Yeah, we want to connect.
So we need legislation to protect from the revenue loss, add back that deduction. So you also have to add back that deduction.
So that's just legislation. That's not part of the disconnect or reconnect policy issues.
We would need some, in many ways, why this is so counterintuitive, it's kind of a perverse result that all this money would flow into taxable income and we actually have a revenue loss. So that to maintain our current policy of adding back all of the federal deductions and sticking with our own, we need legislation that says, well, you have to add back this new one as well. And I'm still trying to connect all the dots. So I'm sure I'll be hearing from people to the points that I just got incorrect.
I know how that goes. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate, not so much for the committee members, but for the public who then starts ringing our phone off, sort of where we are here, and help Chris, because, I mean, in full disclosure, the leadership in both sides have been in the revenues have been looking at this, and we don't know what we don't know. I mean, this does apply to C corporations. It is booked back to 1986, so if the IRS had a computer system better than Oregon's, they could simply go into the tax filings, tell us a finite number, because this has been booked on the tax books since 1986. So we know somebody knows the number, ain't us. Apparently, it's not the IRS either. And then there is no agreement, and I don't want anybody to leave here thinking that we have sneaky corporations or sneaky tax people or anybody going out trying to figure out how to manipulate the system. Nobody can figure out the law yet. That's the point here, is that the hypothetical that was just put forward, if this is in fact correct or close to correct, then there is a problem on how we fix it. The discussions that have come on so far, it is us trying to figure it out. We've asked people in the private sector. They haven't figured it out. So they're not suggesting at this point, mostly, that they have some way to manipulate the system. We just don't know at this particular point. And I want to make sure everybody understands that. It's not, well, they're going to do this, and we got to go do this. We certainly are going to have to reconnect. We just don't know the answers to those questions at this point. And, in fact, some of us, like, frankly, I'll just be blunt, the corporate answer, which is they're going to send us a check better than what we have right now. So, but that's a hypothetical, too. So we don't really know. And I don't want people to kind of, because I see all our colleagues in the interest groups out there, you know, mind spinning like this. And it's like, okay, we don't know on this one. That's the point here.
And to that point, I've had conversations with people who would disagree with the way I just characterize it, and because it's still uncertain. And until everybody can be on the same page about what the law is or isn't, that's precisely why there isn't a dollar estimate to this policy yet. Because if there's disagreement, if we don't know if it's plus or minus, yeah, I'm kind of stuck. So all I could do was flag that for right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chris.
Okay, so to jump in a little bit on the some detailed information on the Oregon impacts. So we're jumping back to full year filers. And the question is, are people getting a tax increase or tax decrease? So at the federal level, we're talking about Oregon full year filers, just Oregonians. About 70% of them will get a reduction in their federal taxes, 10% will see an increase, and 20% no change. Now, for these same full-year filers, on their Oregon taxes, 30% will be a decrease, 40% an increase, and 30% no change. And once all of the interactions are worked out. And then for itemizers at the federal level, we're expecting those who itemize their deductions to fall from 40% down to 15%. And the Department of Revenue is working through some potential implications for that. But this is one of the ways it's been characterized as simplifying the tax system. We're going from that 25% of these filers no longer have to itemize. They're just going to claim the standard deduction, so their taxes get a lot simpler. Now, for Oregon, though, the number of itemizers is not expected to change. It's going to remain around 45 to 50%. We're right around 47%. And a big piece of that is, under Oregon law, you cannot deduct Oregon income taxes against the Oregon tax. So that's one piece. We also have the Oregon standard deductions are much lower. For single filers, it's about $2,000. And for joint filers, it's about $4,000. So the threshold is a lot lower for itemizing. And you don't have to, whatever you do at the federal level, you don't have to do at the Oregon level. I mean, you can take the standard deduction at the federal level and itemize your Oregon taxes. So here's a detailed table. This provides a little more insight on the unusual patterns to the policy changes. So these are preliminary Oregon revenue impacts. And the total numbers here correspond to what were in that first chart. And for the large pieces here, you can see the pass-through piece is what drives the negative total impact. So in 2018, a $45 million estimated net impact is driven by a $180 million revenue loss on the pass-through policy. there are actually revenue increases. Property taxes will increase by some amount because taxpayers won't be able to deduct on their Oregon return. The property tax deduction will be limited to $10,000. So if my property taxes are $12,000 under prior law, I could deduct that full amount, but now I'll only be able to deduct the $10,000. So that's a source of revenue increase. The miscellaneous is a combination of those miscellaneous deductions and some other pieces all thrown into one. And so that this disaggregates some of the trends here. And on the business side, these are those total numbers that were in that first chart, but we can see where the bonus depreciation starts off at about a $75 million revenue loss for a couple years and then turns positive in the outer years. The R&D has no impact for a few years and then a positive impact going out. And then the net interest deduction is large there. So depending on the policy you're looking at, we have a very different pattern of a revenue impact.
Mr. Chair. Senator Butcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, you don't have deduction for state income tax. That's part of that $10,000 cap too.
This is the Oregon impact. Okay. So Oregon taxes under current law, Oregon, when you calculate your Oregon taxes, you're not allowed to deduct your Oregon income tax against your Oregon taxes.
I know that, but your Oregon taxes, you're allowed to deduct up to $10,000 the next year on the federal income tax, and since you're not going to subtract that, isn't that going to elevate your tax liability for the state? Because you're not going to be able to deduct that on your federal taxes. So in 2016, I have I pay $10,000 to Oregon. On 2017, I should be able to deduct that $10,000 from the federal. But now that there's a cap between the income and the property tax, I won't be able to deduct that, so that will make the tax liability higher.
At the way we're thinking the cap works, so at the federal level, you add up your income taxes and property taxes, and on my Schedule A, I deduct up to $10,000.
Right.
Now I go to calculate my Oregon return. The income taxes aren't relevant, and I can deduct up to $10,000 of my property tax. Those don't have to be the same. I mean, in some respects, if I have, $6,000 of property taxes and $7,000 of income taxes, so that's $13,000 at the feds, I get to deduct only $10,000. It's not necessarily colored income or property.
Right.
And then on Oregon, I still get to deduct my $6,000.
But currently, you would be able to deduct more money than we will in the future, so that means your tax liability for Oregon in the following year will be higher.
Right. Part of that is that's part of where the positive from the property tax piece comes right here. Yeah.
Senator Vocals.
Thank you, Chair. In the future, because I know you don't have an evidence, it's very hard to deal in. Don't explain the DOR and to me. On that pass-through right there, in the future, because this is, of course, driven by the federal tax policy, are you guys going to be able to come back to us and split that out, at least initially, in the active versus passive? We have an active pass-through law. They have an active and passive. And are you guys going to be able to do an analysis of that 182 of which is active and which is passive?
We are hoping to.
Future, right.
In the future. It depends on – I mean, the IRS is scrambling to get everything together. So it depends on how the information is reported. Under the current Schedule E, we can separate out passive income and non-passive income. And the folks at DOR, they have their research section. They're doing a lot of good work and spending a lot of time in trying to parse all of that out under the current system. So at some level, I'm optimistic that we'll be able to get some sense. And we're still trying to figure out how the two policies will either fit together or not fit together.
But you follow up, Mr. Chair? But you understand we have an active, and
correct.
When you add passive, it gets really big fast, which is why we did not do that. And passive doesn't necessarily have any creation of jobs or anything.
Good.
It's just, correct. It is, I think it was described, and you don't have to comment, by somebody in the Economist world around here, that this is sort of like a de facto capital gains tax cut. That's sort of what it is. But sort of like, that's not the right terminology, but if you want to compare it. And so that's why, I mean, having a breakdown of its impact in terms of active versus passive, especially since it's capped at 450,000 backwards to 350, that, you know, that's really a smaller, that's at the low end if it was in our policy. So that's why I'm asking the question. And I know we don't have an answer today,
yeah,
and it's going to take some work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So how would you characterize this then, Chris? At $55 million, that's the revenue loss for Oregon if we did nothing?
Correct. All of these numbers are a kind of current law. These are all the provisions that we, because of the rolling reconnect, we think we're already tied to.
Okay.
And these are preliminary, and we're continuing to poke at them, so they may change, but we're driven by the deadline of being February for the legislature to act or not act, and then all of this will be rolled into the February 6th, the forecast.
Okay, and the caveat on the repatriation issue is still hanging out there.
Right. So it, one possibility, so taken together here, we have a $100 million loss in 2018. If what I described about the international is incorrect, and let's say it's a $100 million revenue gain, then that wipes that out. But if what I was describing is correct, maybe it's a $100 million loss, and instead of being $100 million down, we're $200 million down. I'm making up those numbers
right,
for right now. But because we don't know the direction right now, that's...
Senator Boquist.
And in the land of so much information we don't know what the state economist's opinion is of this whole thing either. So he could come in and say, well, we agree with all this, but we don't agree with Chris. We agree with them. I'm just pointing out we know a lot of nothing in two major categories here, and those are the two most impactful, which hopefully in the next 10 days, February forecast is what date?
The 16th, I believe.
16th. Well, hopefully before then we'll have clarity.
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of conversations, LRO and DOR talking about this, and then OEA also. So we're all trying to be on the same page about the impact so that there aren't any surprises.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, so I don't know if I'm in disagree with you or not, but if you're overestimating pass-through because people aren't taking advantage of accelerated depreciation or bonus depreciation, then that could change this pretty quick too, correct?
Yes. The in the slang that we use, it's what we call stacking. All of these provisions interact with each other. And that's one of the challenging pieces about breaking these out by policy is it really depends on the specifics of a company. If I'm a pass-through entity and I'm going to take advantage of that, to build on your example, if I'm following you correctly, and I take advantage of a bonus depreciation, maybe I don't have any income, so I don't benefit from that. I don't have that deduction. Right. Now, the timing of that, I'll be talking to my CPA, well, should I buy that now or next year, you know, and all those kinds of, but I think the key point is that all of these step on each other, and that is very much true.
Okay. Well, thank you for all of that, Chris. It's I know this presentation is really a work in progress in the coming month, so we'll stay tuned. And Kyle, we'll move on to our own pass-through tax policy, and you guys can trade places.
So you got to figure it out, Mr. Chair?
I got a plan. You're going to like it. You're going to like it.
I got it. Yeah, disconnect from the whole thing.
That's one idea. Whether we like it and agree with it are two different things.
Yeah.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, we will be switching gears here. There's going to be some overlap in the discussion topics, but what I'm going to be going through is really an update on an Oregon-specific policy here in Oregon related to pass-through companies. As Chris mentioned, the Oregon-specific change, so the lower rates, and I'll get into hold. What I plan to do today is I'll re-describe or I'll give an overview of what the policy was that was passed back in 2013, the special session, and then get into some updated numbers that we've seen for the next tax year, the tax year 2016. So Chris did an update on this a little over a year ago with the 2015 tax year figures. We now have another year of the 2016 returns. The numbers are still preliminary, but at this point, they shouldn't change much going forward. But so again, the pass-through policy that we have here in Oregon is specific to, it's aimed at S corporations and partnerships, and then potentially LLCs, depending on how they're being taxed. But the difference there with what you just heard about the Fed policy is the Fed policy, that 20% deduction, also included sole proprietorships. That's not included in Oregon's policy. So Oregon's policy is just touching on the S corps and the partnerships, and also is pointed at that non-passive income. So passive income is not subject to the lower rates here in Oregon. So those are a couple key distinctions just between the Fed and Oregon's policy as well. So how those two will interact, again, those are things that we'll be continuing to follow up on. But so just as a reminder, this was a change that came into place, House Bill 3601, 2013 special session, and it's providing preferential tax rates to non-passive income for S-corps and LLCs. And the policy was specifically directed at having those lower tax rates apply to the income that is non-passive. So again, that's a key component here. And one of the primary requirements is also the taxpayer must materially participate in the business. And that's how it becomes non-passive rather than passive. So if you're just an initial investor, say you provide $50,000 or something in seed money to a company that's starting up, if you're not actively involved in that company going forward, any income you're going to be receiving in future years, part of those profits are going to be coming in as passive income to you. But if you're materially participating in it, that's when it becomes non-passive income. And we do, for that definition, we do tie to the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, using that material participation definition. And that's what's up there in the slide there.
Which is what?
The key part there is the individual is receiving the income, so the income that's coming through on the individual income tax return from the S-Corp, regular, continuous, and substantial interaction with the business entity that the income came from. So again, if you're just an investor, that's going to be passive income. But if you are involved, if perhaps you're an employee or you're one of the directors or to some extent, if you're actively involved in that business, making the decisions, hiring, firing, those type of things, that's where it becomes non-passive income. So there is a distinction there. And the way that the IRC defines it is almost it describes what's passive income, and then anything that's not passive is non-passive. Is the way it gets described. But that's Oregon originally in the legislation tried to put in day-to-day operations and different things in the statute. That was subsequently changed the following year to tie to this IRC definition, the federal definition. Other requirements are that the business must have at least one full-time non-investor employee, and that employee must account for 1,200 hours in Oregon worked. So there are a couple additional requirements as well. So the key to the specific rate policy here in Oregon is the rate difference applied to that income. So just to give you some ability to contrast here, the joint income tax rates, this is for a joint filer, you have the standard 5, 7, 9, and 9.9 income tax rates here in Oregon. And you can see there's the tax brackets there as well. The second box there is describing the non-passive income tax rates. And so these are the preferential rates that Oregon has, and they point directly to that non-passive income that's coming in from the S-Corp or the partnership. And you can see there the first $250,000 in that non-passive income will be taxed at 7%. And that would compare to the standard rate brackets that begin at, again, these are marginal rates, so you have the 5, 7, and 9. But you can see the difference there is the 7% from, say, the 9.9 or 7% to 9%. So there could be a 2% reduction, percentage point reduction in the rates. But that's where the benefit comes, is the rates are lower for the non-passive income tax rates, but they do step up. So I do have the brackets over here. These are marginal again. So your first $250,000 would be taxed at 7%. $250,000 to $500 is then taxed at 7.2%. So when you earn that extra dollar, you don't then all the income doesn't jump into that 7.2% bracket or so forth, to the discussion we were having earlier.
Senator Boquist.
And just for clarification, so it's not a clean comparison between state and federal, but only the federal side only deals with the 7.2% minus, because it's a $450,000 cap, and then the federal side adds in active to it too, right?
for Senator, for the 20%, you're speaking about the 20%
yes,
reduction?
Right.
Yeah.
The new federal tax policy is only 350 with a phase down to 450 for the income earner, and its difference between us is that it has active, what you call non-passive and passive income in it, active versus. Right.
That's correct, yes, yeah. Senator. The as best as we can tell right now, it looks like, and even the wording of how it was done at the federal level is not typical in the way it was written, how they're going to have that deduction work. But it would appear you would sum your non-passive and your passive income, and then you would take your 20% deduction from that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And so just one last note on the brackets. You can see once you get over $5 million in non-passive income, you do meet that 9.9% tax rate. So dollars over $5 million are then taxed at the same tax rate as our base tax. So that's where the preferential, you still get the preferential rates for that first $5 million in income, but after that, you're taxed at the same rate, the 9.9. So the benefit then, you no longer see benefit on dollars above that or income above that. So what you have here on slide number 4 is just a comparison of the calculation, and one of the key points of the preferential tax rates, and I guess I'll walk through this briefly here to better understand it, but when you take the preferential tax rates, you do not get to then apply the deductions, your deductions on your return, whether they're the standard deduction or the itemized deductions, against that non-passive taxable income. And so just to go over briefly, the base approach, and Chris even had a slide similar to this, but you have your income, subtract deductions, multiply that by the tax rates, and that's your gross tax. Now, you could have credits that come off of that as well, but that's the simplified example of how it works. Using the preferential rates, and again, there's an option for the individual to decide whether to use these or not, because there could be cases where the preferential rates, because not allowing those deductions, won't end in a net benefit for the income tax filer. They get to opt in or opt out, or they have to opt in to use these preferential rates. So if the preferential rates won't end in a net benefit for the individual, we wouldn't expect them, or the joint filer wouldn't expect them to use these preferential rates. So it can reduce your taxes, but it can't increase your taxes, so long as you don't opt in incorrectly. But so with the opt-in approach, you would take your non-passive income and you'd multiply that by the new rates. And that's the rates here on the last slide. And then that would be your gross tax, what's labeled as B1. And then you take all the other income on your return. So if you're a joint return, you could have one of the joint filers could be a wage earner or something like that. So you have all the other income. You run that through as normal, subtract your deductions, multiply that by our standard 5.7, 9.9 rates. That's gross tax B2. You sum those together, and that's your net tax liability. And so if by doing that you come up with a net benefit, then we would expect someone to opt into this approach. But if that loss of deductions against that non-passive income results in a what would be computed as a tax increase, we would not expect someone to opt in to this preferential tax rate approach. And there is a schedule DOR has put together that walks a filer through this exact computation, and it basically says take the lower of the two. So it should result in no confusion, hopefully, there for someone who works through that form. So that's the policy description, or the brief policy description. Now I'll get into the tax year 2016 numbers, and then also a comparison with the tax year 2015, and a comparison as well to the original revenue impact, so how we're tracking with that original revenue impact from the legislation in 2013. So before I get into these, I just want to make a note, too, that this information is coming from our colleagues over at Department of Revenue, the research section there. And they do, this is coming from the tax returns and the specific forms. So there are some computations that are done by that group there that are providing these things, providing these figures to us. So I just want to give them the credit there. So the revenue impact for tax year 2016, what you see in front of you here is the number of claimants and the revenue impact. So the income category here on the left, starting point, this is referring to the total income on the return. So this includes the any non-passive income there is. It could also include the passive income and any other income that's being claimed on the return. So in that example I gave earlier, if one of the filers is a wage earner, that wage income is here as well. So that's just a key thing to keep in mind on the income category. And you can see the total fiscal year filers, And these are full year filers. I should note that this doesn't include the part year and the non-residents. But for the full year filers in 2016, we had about 1.7 million filers, full year filers. And of that, the claimants that actually took advantage of this reduced rate structure, 22,500 or so, 22,448. And you can all see the claimants changes as you move up the income scale, where if you're looking at the 200 to 500,000 in income, about 12% of all those filers, of the 64,000 filers, claimed this reduced rate or took advantage of this reduced rate. The overall revenue impact for tax year 2016, about $95 million. That's where we have it.
So, Kyle, among the proposals that are out there is to cap this at 250,000, 500,000. That effectively then takes out that $65 million.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I actually have a slide later on that shows the tax cut that I can, yeah, I'll circle back to the LC that was introduced and how that relates. Yes.
I have a funny feeling that you're
right.
Senator Boklis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, in the future, do your peers at Department of Revenue have the capacity to create an apples-to-apples slide to the federal tax code that would change the bottom three brackets, and 100 would go to 100 to 350,000. Then there would be a 350 to 450,000, and then there would be a 400,000 going up. And the reason I'm asking that question is an apples-to-apples comparison, because the federal code and the federal impact, active and passive, only applies to this slide till it hits 350 and then 450, and then we are completely out of comparison. You understand what I'm saying? I'm looking for data. I know you don't have it right now, but do we have that capacity at DOR to ask them to produce, to give you a little bit more data in there so that we have a more precise comparison for policy purposes?
Yes, Senator Boquist. Yeah, we can definitely work on getting that apples-to-apples comparison, because I understand. I think I understand the point
right.
You're making.
I can explain it later, but you see where I'm going here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find out, because
you want the brackets to match.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we thought this. Some of us thought this might be a more less complicated discussion, but we now really have not multiple. We don't have two comparisons. We have about four policies now competing with each other, and we haven't even added in Section 179 impacts to the small business either. So this is getting complex very quickly.
Yeah,
thank you.
Absolutely, Senator. Yeah, we'll just leave it at yes.
Right, just yes, right.
Yeah.
Well, good. Thank you, Department of Revenue. We paid for the computer. We're hoping this can work now.
So moving on to slide number six, this is the revenue impacts, and it's a comparison between what we saw in tax year 2015 and tax year 2016. So these are the 2 years of data that we have. So in tax year 2015, the revenue impact total was about $66.3 million. We've seen that's grown to $95.3 million for tax year 2016. And then the number of claimants, you can see, also increased from about 13,400 to the 22,500. And I do have a couple charts down here that are showing the exact same information that's in the tables. But to give you some sense in terms of the claimants, we did see increased number of claimants in all the different income brackets. It was tilted a little bit more heavily to the lower income categories here. So we saw, if you see the growth in over 500,000, about 43%, that compares to 0 to 50,000 of 160%. And because we've seen a little bit more growth on in the lower income categories, we can see the average tax benefit has decreased from a bit under $5,000, $4,958, to $4,244 in 2016. So just comparing this to the original revenue impact, and there's importance to this as well. I'll get to that in the final slide. But so the original revenue impact had the impact about $205 million in 2015-17. And then growing over time, you can see in the bienniums. Comparing it specifically to the tax years, the original estimate for 2015 was $91.1 million. What came in was about $66.3, a difference of $24.9 million. For 2016, the original estimate was $98.5, and it looks like about 95.3 is where we have it today as the revenue loss. So pretty much in line with what was expected from that original estimate done in 2013. And this this kind of connects a little bit with some of the anecdotal feedback we've heard, where initially it may have flown under the radar a bit, this preferential tax rate. So as it became CPAs and individuals became more aware of this, we've seen the usage pick up a bit.
Houston. May I speak?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Didn't think you were done.
Kyle, just, and not now, but one of the things that I think all of us have heard, and we've had testimony before, which is another wrinkle in this, is whether it's amenable or not amenable. Do you have, is there any mechanism for us, or us, you, just throw it on you, okay, for you, if we looked at this and say, if we made this, you know, you could amend returns, because typically you can amend terms, amend returns, what would happen, any way to even do a revenue forecast if we went back and said, okay, nobody really gamed it, we want to go back because of the tax liability, or the tax preparer liability issue, okay, which is the key issue here, if we amended it to allow it to be amendable, wow, okay. Is there a way to do some sort of estimated forecast on that that you can think of, or would it just be really challenging?
Well, Senator, we'll put together an estimate on anything you'd like us to do.
that was awesome.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
But yeah, no, there would be ways to try to get us some sense of that. I mean, just one that comes off the top of my head is just looking at individuals that claimed this in 2016 that didn't in 2015 and had a similar return or something to that effect, where we could see they would have benefited from this, but for whatever reason they didn't take advantage of it.
Right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Buckley.
Since you've had the pleasure of being in the room with all of us for the last three sessions doing the same thing, I think you're familiar with the issue of, you know, one of the issues that's been raised when you get out of whether it is raised, what is this, so on and so forth, is this whole deal. Could CPAs be liable because they made a mistake and they can't amend the tax return? And that's really what I'm driving at. Is there a way we could come up with a revenue forecast that, if we wanted to, not saying we do, but if we wanted to come up with a revenue forecast that, say, if we went back and said, okay, we're going to fix this so they can amend the returns, so that it eliminates the whether there is or perceived or whatever liability that the CPA can't do an amended return because he didn't know about it. I mean, is that even feasible, or is that just really a swag? And that's sort of what I was asking for. I don't need an answer now, but that's the genesis of the question. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So slide number 8, this is the tax reduction distribution for tax year 2016. And this was the slide I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, that helps to maybe frame exactly what would happen by putting in a different bracket structure or limiting it, similar to what the LC that's in the up there in OLIS right now would do. But you can see the returns, the way that this is structured is it has the actual tax cut or the categories here on the left, and then the returns, number of returns that received that tax cut, essentially. So you can see just by working off the top here, less than $5,000 tax cut was about 80% of the returns. Received a net tax cut of less than $5,000. And the charts over here combine the two categories, but maybe give a better sense of, for the less than $10,000, so a combination of these two, the number of claimants was about 90% received a tax reduction of less than $10,000. And they represent about 42% of the overall revenue impact. And just based on, it will depend upon each individual's return, but as a rough approximate, by eliminating it, say, sticking with what's there in the LC, I think it limits the taxable income only to the first $250,000, and you get that 7%. You would be looking at, depending if it's a joint return or a single return, a tax cut of about $4,500 to $5,500 or so would be your max benefit. Now, again, it'll depend upon the different deductions and the structure of someone's return, but that gives you some sense of, if you limit it to the $5,000, you have $5,000 per return could be the average benefit. Now, of course, that would allow every claimant of this to earn those $5,000. So it wouldn't be simply just taking the 42% of the figure, but it'd be the number of claimants essentially times that $5,000, $5,500 figure would give you some sense of where we'd be. But again, it'll depend upon how, like you mentioned, that there may be amendments or something to that LC going forward. But we can definitely prepare those as they come up. slide number 9 has just the impacts by county. So this works with the similar to the previous slides. We have the number of filers, so that's the total number of Oregon income tax filers, full year filers in that county. You have the number of claimants, that share, so the number of claimants that represent that share of the total filers in the county, to give you some sense of where this is being used, and then the total figures. So from the numbers that we have, every county has at least one claimant that's taken advantage of this reduced rate structure. So it is spread throughout Oregon, Oregon's 36 counties. It's used more heavily, probably unsurprisingly, in some of the more urban county areas, more the metro areas and such.
Kyle, the share that you have there and the percentage is the number of claimants to filers, not the amount of money. Do you have that somewhere?
Yes, I'm sure we could. Yeah, we could put that together.
I mean,
well,
I just, in some quick, really quick, and back of the envelope math, looks like the three county areas in Portland urban area are by far take the lion's share of this, more than half.
And the sheet says in there.
You know, one of the complaints about this, to the extent that there are complaints, is that this is going to law firms and medical clinics in Portland, in the Portland area. And seeing that figure might help substantiate that or debunk it. So.
Okay, yeah. And that's one of the things I know that our office has worked on in the past, is trying to tie this up, and this is, of course, working with DOR data as well, to different sectors, if you will, NAICS sectors and such, to get a sense of who's claiming this and in what type of business type. And that becomes even more important in how that relates to the new federal change as well, which once you get above those brackets and the phase out and everything that Chris described, it then, the 20% deduction at the federal level doesn't apply to certain types of income.
Right. They went after that trap.
Yeah.
And which we did. So.
So that is, yeah, that is something that we have looked at in the past as another lever or tweak or something like that that could be made as a policy change, and what those impacts would be as they settle out. Okay, and then the last slide I have here is a requirement that's in statute right now, and that is there's two instances of this. So the first one will be prior to July 1st, 2018, where LRO is required to compare the actual revenue impact with what was originally forecast in that 2013 bill, so what was in the original revenue impact statement. And dependent upon how the actual compares to the estimate, the rates are then adjusted. So in 2018, the first adjustment that would happen in 2018 would be if the revenue impact was coming in greater than the initial estimated revenue impact, so the actual is exceeding the estimate, then those the preferential rates would be reduced downward to reflect that, to bring that more in line. Now, based upon what the information we have for 15 and 16 hit pretty much spot on with the original estimate. 15 came in below. That doesn't look like that's something that's going to happen here in 2018, because we're below the estimated revenue impact from the original impact statement. Going forward, we'll do this computation again in 2022, but it adds in a secondary where we'll compare the actual revenue change with the original estimate, and then whether that comes in above or below, the rates can be adjusted either upwards or downwards to more reflect it in line with the actual revenue impact. So the first one was just testing if the revenue impact's larger than we expected, then we'd adjust the rates down. The second one we'll do in 2022 would compare it and say, well, okay, if it exceeds it per the statute, then the rates could potentially be reduced to provide more tax benefit or increased to reduce that tax benefit, so that it could affect both sides there. But again, that'll be done prior to July 1, 2022, and assuming there's no other changes going forward.
Okay. Any other questions, Kyle, on our pass-through policy? Okay. Thank you, Kyle. And
thank you.
I know we want to shut down here because some members of this committee are going toward the Super Education Committee soon after this. So we will move on to
the Committee of Indentured Servitude.
The corporate taxation and throwback sales. Just when you thought tax policy couldn't get any more technical or wonky, we're going to go to throwback sales.
Well, I'll see you in Burnt River. We go to the school there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jeff Henderson with the Oregon Department of Revenue Corporation Section, here today to discuss Oregon's throwback rule as it relates to income, apportionment of corporate income. I have a couple slides here that just set the stage of how we came to adopt the throwback rule, where it came from, a little background about Oregon's apportionment formula, method, and then we'll dive in to talk about the throwback rule. So apportionment, super high level, it really came about from the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. We've talked about UDIPA and that model law that was adopted by state taxing officials, called for a fair method of dividing a multi-state corporation's income amongst up amongst the states in which it does business. Oregon adopted that model law in 1965. The original UDIPA, as adopted in 57, called for an equal-weighted three-factor formula consisting of a sales, payroll, and property factor. However, majority of states, including Oregon, have shifted away from that equal-weighted apportionment method to a heavier-weighted sales factor, or even a single sales factor. So here's Oregon's history of our apportionment formula. We were tied to that model, that UDIPA recommendation, up until 1991, when we gradually shifted away from the equal-weighted to a more heavier-weighted sales factor, and then up until the point of 2005, when Oregon went to a single sales factor formula for apportioning a multi-state corporation's business income. And again, just to, at a really high level, apportionment only applies to multi-state corporations, those that do business in multiple states. So if we're talking about an Oregon-only corporation that conducts business only in Oregon, has sales only in Oregon, those corporations would be taxed on 100% of their taxable income. Whereas a multi-state corporation, their taxable income is split up using the apportionment formula. So UDIPA, it identifies two categories of receipts. You have receipts from the sales of tangible personal property, and then the other category is everything else, all other receipts, primarily services and intangibles, but that category also includes receipts from the sale, rental, lease, or licensing of real property, and also receipts from the rental, lease, or license of tangible personal property. So the throwback rule, again, we adopted that when we brought UDIPA into statute. That's found in 314.665, subsection 2B, and it only applies to receipts from the sale of tangible personal property. So that huge other category of everything else, the throwback rule does not apply there. UDIPA, it requires the method for sourcing those sales of tangible personal property. It calls for those receipts to be assigned or sourced to the state to where that tangible property is delivered, with two exceptions, two throwback exceptions. In the case of those exceptions, the receipts from that sale of tangible personal property would be thrown back and assigned to the state from which the tangible personal property was shipped, if the purchaser is the United States government, or if the taxpayer is not subject to tax in the state to where that property is delivered. If that taxpayer is protected from taxation, this throwback rule says, okay, well, that sale will then be thrown back and assigned to the state from which the property was shipped. The intent of the design of the throwback rule was to ensure that a taxpayer's receipts were assigned, entirely all assigned to a state to which it was taxable, to avoid nowhere sales being sales that would, receipts that would not be assigned to any state. So in the situation where you have no throwback rule for sales of tangible personal property, a taxpayer would make sales of tangible personal property into a state where they're not subject to tax. A real common situation is because of federal law, Public Law 86-272, which prohibits states from imposing an income tax on corporations that do limited activities in that state regarding sales of tangible personal property, typically merely solicitation of sales, having staff in the state soliciting sales is a protected activity, would not subject them to tax. So the result of nowhere sales, you would have, when you get to your apportionment formula, which Oregon's single sales method calls for, you take your Oregon sales and you have that over your total sales everywhere. And so when you look at the apportionment formula, nowhere sales would be reflected in the everywhere, but they wouldn't be assigned to any state. So they wouldn't be shown in the numerator of any state sales factor, but they would be shown in the factor itself in the denominator. And that would just result in taxation of less than 100% of a taxpayer's taxable income.
You have a hypothetical of a nowhere sale that would fall under this.
Yeah. So to the extent there is a slide later on that kind of talks about, shows what other states do. Mr. Chair, an example would be for a state that does not have a throwback rule with regards to sales of TPP, tangible personal property. They make that sale into a state to customers where they're not subject to tax in that state. But because the state where that corporation is located, their domicile state, doesn't have a throwback rule, those sales would not be thrown back, would not be reflected in the sales factor numerator. They just would not be assigned. So there's a slide here coming up that a very high-level example that might help coming up. Again, the throwback rule only impacts sales of tangible personal property, and it only touches the Oregon sales factor for corporations that ship goods outside of the state. So when you have an out-of-state corporation that is making sales to Oregon customers but not taxable in Oregon because of Public Law 6272, the throwback rule does not impact their Oregon sales factor. It only impacts the sales factor of Oregon corporations. So that's that last bullet point there just clarifies for an out-of-state corporation that is not taxable in Oregon, but they are part of a unitary consolidated group that files an Oregon return, so the group itself is subject to tax in Oregon. This specific out-of-state corporation is not subject to tax, protected by Public Law 6272. The sales factor would not be impacted by Oregon's throwback rule. So just to recap that, it only impacts the sales factor of Oregon corporations. Mr. Chair, here's a very simple high-level example. So we have an Oregon corporation. Total receipts of $1 million. The sales that are delivered to its Oregon customers equal $600,000. Those are going to be sourced to Oregon, reflected in the sales factor numerator. This Oregon corporation also has $400,000 of sales delivered to states where it is not taxable. So with Oregon's throwback, that $400,000 is thrown back to Oregon and assigned to the Oregon sales factor numerator. Nowhere sales in this example would be zero because that $400,000 is thrown back. That Oregon corporation would then have an Oregon sales factor of 100%. Without a throwback, so hypothetical, without a throwback, the Oregon sales factor would be 60%. It would just be those $600,000 of sales to Oregon customers that would be assigned, sourced to Oregon, included in the sales factor numerator. The $400,000 of sales to customers outside the state, in a state where the corporation is not subject to tax, would not be thrown back and ultimately would not be sourced to any state. And so you would have $400,000 of sales that were not included in the sales factor numerator, but they would be part of the sales factor, still part of the computation. So in this example, super high-level example, 60% of their taxable income would be taxed. There'd be 40% not subject to tax.
Okay. Thanks.
other states' approaches, it is fairly split. Even 21 states do have a throwback rule. 24 states do not. Of those 24 that do not have a throwback rule for sales of tangible personal property, they do have a throw out, which is removes it entirely from the sales factor. And then five states that do not impose a corporate income tax.
Those are those five states are, of course, receipts tax states.
That's right.
You're probably the wrong person to ask this, but what is, and maybe you can weigh in too, Chris. Large businesses, the business community, do not like the throwback rule. Is that only because they will ultimately maybe pay less taxes because of the nowhere sales, or what is the problem here that they keep complaining about?
Well, that could potentially be part of it, but the state, from a policy perspective, the state has been moving, starting with the single sales factor, and then even up through last session with the market-based, the policy is to focus corporate taxation on having the connection to the Oregon economy, so having it measured only by the Oregon economy. So to the extent that a corporation is making sales in other states, that sale to Iowa or Florida isn't part of the Oregon economy. So there is a policy disconnect.
Okay. Questions? Jeff? Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good.
All right, committee, all of this is a work in progress. Thank you for your attention today. And thanks to all who helped out in this presentation. It was very thoughtful and dense, and I appreciate it. So until next time, we are adjourned.